This week, we order a Diet Coke with our Whopper and fries. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
To remind
process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome to episode 84. Today is June 11th, 2015. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob.
Welcome to episode 84. And this is a special episode. We are here once again at GC Food and Brewery, and they remodeled the bar just for us. Can you imagine? I can't believe how much they spent remodeling this place
and
just
had
for
to
us.
Cram more people in here for the maddening crowd.
It's awesome. It is simply awesome. We have a very special guest with us on this episode that Rob arranged for us. Thank you, Rob.
He prepared ahead of time. It was very surprising.
Very rare.
Yes, Rob has spent all of his prep time for the rest of the show on this one episode, so we're not going to get anything else out of him.
That's pretty much true.
So we're talking about shame on this episode. So let me just open up with a couple of comments here. So this episode, we should be ashamed of ourselves. No, really, we should. We've all done things that we're not terribly proud of, like the first 83 episodes. But it is this sense of shame and concern for our own reputation upon which hinges our entire ability to self-govern. Shame is peer pressure in its most essential form and can be a powerful force for good or bad. I think some people, perhaps a growing number of people, as we've discussed recently, want to live a shame-free, judgment-free life, and it's for this reason that when they see others getting called out, that they immediately leap to their defense. But the fact remains, there are certain actions and certain conduct that is shameful. A list of those behaviors might be completely subjective, but that's nothing a little righteous indignation can't fix. Let me also say that our break music is provided once again by the Polish ambassador. And without further ado, I would like to turn it over to Rob, who is going to introduce our special guest.
We have a special guest tonight. We have Mr. Keith Hauser is our special guest tonight. We're going to ask him a bunch of questions about things that he's done in his life and some recent events. Keith, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and the listeners?
Sure. My name is Keith Hauser. I'm the president of the St. Louis Military Officer Support Foundation, as well as Shark Fitness Training. We've been around as far as the fitness avenue for about 15 years now. I've been a trainer for 20, but the company started 15. And I've been working with the military in a volunteer capacity with our nonprofit for about 11 years now. So we provide training to men and women from the St. Louis area who are entering the military as an officer or enlisting with a military or a combat MOS or life-saving MOS. And last year, we began to offer the same kind of training, fitness, weapons, combatives, to local law enforcement.
Okay. Very cool.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's start asking you about some military stuff. Probably
Great.
One of your favorite topics.
Sure, you bet.
So what do you think about mandatory service like is done in South Korea and Israel? You think the U.S. would benefit from such an idea? Or are you like the purely volunteer force?
Well, I think it has to be a volunteer force at this time, although I definitely think that our young people could benefit from some structure and military bearing for a couple of years. We are terribly lacking in terms of motivation and work ethic, and that's something that the military can definitely bring to the table.
Yeah, I mean, we had another question about it. I mean, you're dealing with these high school kids who are aiming to join the academies, and do you think there's like one trait that's part of families that raise kids that have that kind of motivation versus other families, or like what?
Without question.
What do you think the common traits are in such a family?
One of the best aspects of what I do with the military is get to know these families and get to know the individual very close. In many cases, they're like my brother and sister. And I've always seen a very, very strict discipline as they were raised. They're very defined roles. They got great feedback. They had excellent motivation and incentive. But at the same time, there were some pretty stiff consequences growing up. It wasn't the let's go in the corner and think about our actions. It's you're in trouble and there's going to be some punishment involved. And, of course, that's not the case across the board. But discipline seems to be the backbone of all these great young men and women that I've trained over the years.
Did you have discipline and backbone as a kid, Jerry?
No, not in the Marines.
No, what about as a kid growing up?
I had to keep my room clean. Does that count?
Good boy.
My mother came from a military family, and she took it one step too far. My sisters and I all referred to her as the Nazi growing up, because she had a list of guidelines that were horrifically strict. We had weekly inspections. You had to have your clothes organized a very specific way in your drawer, in your closet. You were given a lot of opportunities to succeed, and all the tools that you needed were there for you. But when you crossed the line, you knew it immediately. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There wasn't the 1, 2, 3 count until you get in trouble. I mean, you had a hand coming toward you or a belt coming toward you pretty quick. And I don't think it was quite the case for most of the people I trained. My circumstance was pretty different and pretty radical, I guess, if you look at it like that. But for whatever reason, it worked.
Would you call you or your siblings creative types as well?
I've got 3 half-sisters. They're all quite a bit older than I am. They're very, very different. They are politically the polar opposite of me.
Okay.
I would say not really. There's not a lot of creativity in our family. Unless you talk about the things that just come into my head as I teach classes and kind of barf out. My clients seem to get a kick out of it. And that would be like the only creative gene. As far as musically speaking, we're all absolutely terrible. I couldn't hold a tune to save my life.
So do you think your family's lack of creativity has anything to do with the strict regulations and the requirements for behavior?
It certainly could. My mother adopted my 3 sisters when they were very, very young, so that's really the only mother they knew.
Right.
And there was, I would say there would be some truth to that.
And it shows more of a nurture than the nature thing, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was love by force kind of
right.
thing. You knew you were doing well when you weren't getting your head knocked off or sailed off the table or your belongings were getting trashed on the floor and you were told to reorganize it before you go to bed.
I didn't have quite that. I'm the youngest from a large family. Mm-hmm. And
really large.
Really large. I'm the youngest of 12. My father was in the Navy well before I came along, so I didn't really experience that. But there was a military influence. From my parents, I got more guilt, I think, than anything. It was my siblings who kept me in line. Also, it was, you're just a little runt, you don't know anything,
Right.
I think that shaped me. I didn't have a checklist, not a formal one, but probably some similar guidelines,
sure,
for lack of a better term.
My mother would intentionally fix a couple things a week that she knew that you would gag when you ate, and she said you have to finish it, and that'll give you character and discipline, so when you go to somebody's house in the future and they serve some garbage that's just absolutely rancid, you'll eat it anyway with a smile on your face. And so you'd have to sit there and choke down her famous bean and cheese casserole and endure her god-awful dressings and all the other things she created. I mean, she butchered everything. She was the worst cook ever.
I think my wife's enacting that policy at home. I just didn't know what it was called.
Oh, man.
It's tough love. Tough love.
Well, Rob, it was nice having
you
with us.
I hope she's not listening.
All right.
So I had a question when I was thinking about the officer training. Like, do you think... I mean, these kids are about 17 when they go in, right? And they're about
18.
Okay, yeah. And then how old are they when they finish? 21 or 22?
Well, if they go to an academy, they go in at 18 or 19, and they get out 4 years later. Then they have a 5-year commitment on active service.
Gotcha. So do you ever think that like being 17, 18 is too early to decide such a thing? And then, but aren't you, when you get out, you're 22 and you're in charge of enlisted individuals who may have had more time in service than you?
Oh, without
right?
question.
Right. So. Do you think that system works out just fine? Is there anything you would tweak about it?
Yes. No, not at all. I mean, it's been proven for 200-some years.
Right.
When you see these people come out, and the person who got me involved in this was eventually Captain Charlie Felker.
Okay.
I met him when he was a second-year cadet at West Point, and you could tell from the first time I met him, he's a real leader. And the real leaders know that when they get out of the Service Academy and they go through their training and they're deployed like he was 22 years old. He was a commanding officer of 50 men at the 82nd Airborne on the border of Pakistan. And Charlie, being the leader, knew that if he didn't rely on his NCOs, he was dead.
Yeah, he's over.
It's over.
Yep.
And he told me a great story. He said that he got up and gave his first brief as a commanding officer. And all these men nodded politely, yes, sir, you bet. And his staff sergeant pulls him off the side and said, sir, that was the dumbest goddamn plan I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So let me do it like this. Why don't you let me run the show here for a month and you listen and learn? And at the end of it, it'll be your baby. I'll do anything you ask me to do. And Charlie, with a very wise man, said, sounds great, Staff Sergeant. Let's do it. And he listened and he learned. And he turned out to be one of the Army's finest young officers in modern history.
It's good. Good training.
Absolutely.
Does that bear out with your experience, Jerry? Because you went in when you were 18.
Yeah. And you know, and honestly, I probably would have benefited from this kind of training. I mean, the best I had was my recruiters once a month would have, you know, like a Saturday morning PT session where they invited all the people that they had recruited who they knew were going in. You know, they had a start date.
Right.
But for me, I signed up the summer in between my junior and senior year in high school. So I knew for a full year, you know, that I was going in. So once a month, they gathered everybody together, and, you know, we went and did physical training for a couple hours, and I wouldn't say it was terribly effective. Once a month is not enough to prepare you for Marine Corps boot camp. So, I mean, you know, something like this would have been beneficial.
We've seen some amazing results over the years, and probably the best one I can quote is back in 2010, 1,400 people reported to West Point. And at the end of their initial training called Beast Barracks, our cadets finished number 1, 2, and 3. And we see those things happen a lot. You know, they go up there, they have a very, very well-rounded knowledge of the courtesies or protocols. Mm-hmm. So right off their bat, they're not getting screamed after doing stupid things like saluting the wrong person.
Right.
Then they know weapons training. They have a basics in terms of boxing. They know land navigation. They know how to survive in the water, which is a critical thing. Mm-hmm. We had two guys come to us from the inner city a couple years ago and headed to the Naval Academy. And we had a pool day, and I said, all right, everybody jump in the water and get warm. And they jump in, and they sank right to the bottom. So we fish them out, and I said, what the hell was that? And they said, sir, we've never been in a pool before. And so the next 15, 20 minutes, I grabbed another guy who at the time was the top-ranked water polo player in the state of Missouri. And his first command experience and leadership was me telling him, I want them to be able to swim in a half an hour. And in 20 minutes, he had them doing laps back and forth. They went up to the Naval Academy, and they blew away their survival swimming class, and they passed it without taking it. So they tested out of it. So that's another example of the things that my organization can do.
It's awesome. So, Jerry, you probably had some young – who was your direct, you know, superior officer right when you enlisted or right when you got out of boot camp, I guess? Was it a young officer right out of officer training school?
I was a captain. He hadn't been in too terribly long.
Right.
I went in as a computer programmer. Not a lot of those in the Marine Corps. And he was, you know, one of the few officers in that MOS. So, yeah, you could tell he didn't have a whole lot of experience in that, you know, in that role leading and hadn't been doing it very long.
Yep. So one of my things I think about every election cycle is the whole the constitutional setup of having a commander-in-chief that's not affiliated with the military. Sometimes, you know, some have had former military experience, some have had zero. Like, do you think the Constitution got that one right, or you think they should, you know, mandate 4 years of service to get in?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think any civilian who with proper training and proper attitude, proper perspective, could be an excellent commander-in-chief.
Yeah.
You know, we've had some great ones throughout our history.
Yeah,
I don't think it's an extra requirement. I think, especially in a day and age like today, when we're going to be fighting an unending war against terrorism, that I think it would be tremendously beneficial to have someone who has been in there before and understands what it's like to put a rifle sight on somebody's head and squeeze the trigger.
Right. But the Constitution certainly doesn't require it.
No,
right?
Not at all.
Right.
Not at all. You know, I don't think that should be an absolute prerequisite.
So
I
think they got that one right. I think they got that one right, too. You guys do? That little stipulation. It seems like they were looking forward to the Manuel Noriegas of the world and the military juntas going on. You know, it seemed like they had foresight.
I think that was the point of it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
good job. They got that one right.
You know how I feel about the Constitution.
So since you're on this particular podcast, so as we all are of different political beings, I think you might be familiar with. Jeremy's conservative thoughts and my weenie liberalness. But so let's see if I could try to characterize Jerry's point of view.
I would hope so. After 4 years of doing this, you'd be able to...
Give us a quick summary, Jerry, of you know, just how your views differ from...
So a lot of people think anarchy is a system, and it's not. It's simply a rejection of what we perceive to be the systemic evil in a centralized government. Mm-hmm. So if you don't believe that evil is the right way to do things, then you reject any form of centralized government. That's basically where an anarchist is coming from. Mm-hmm. So the Constitution, while I respect some parts of it, you know, I think they got some of it right. Some of it they got very wrong. You know, that black people were 3/5 of a person. That copyright should be a law. You know, there's a lot of things in the Constitution that shouldn't be there. But, you know, I respect the rule of law, but I don't necessarily think that law needs to be written down.
And I think you're very sensitive to the idea of a majority deciding, possibly being able to remove the rights of a minority just by being more of them.
Sure.
It seems like that's kind of what the Constitution does lay out rights for certain individuals and provides the ability for the Supreme Court or the courts to strike down laws against the minority that affect the minority. But it's kind of there's still a built-in system that allows the majority to...
It allows 50.1% to tyrannize the 49.9%, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting how, like, I don't have a military background at all, but how all the oath, there's many oaths and language in the military that talks about the Constitution. So do you ever think about that when you're thinking about, you know, the oaths that young officers take or even any military man to kind of swear and uphold the Constitution? Kind of all the great parts of the Constitution, but the kind of warts within it and the kind of the dangers within the Constitution?
Well, I think you have to provide a framework. You have to provide a chain of command. I think that's essential, especially in military service where you have people that, if I outrank you, you have to do anything I tell you to do, and there has to be some sort of framework around that. I think that question would probably be better answered by somebody who's taken that oath and who's had to raise their hand and do that, which I have not.
Right, but just for civilians, not necessarily military people. I mean, I think I always feel, you know, as a Catholic, I always feel a little bit, I didn't think of this when I was younger, but now I feel a little bit more apprehensive to have oaths to documents or oaths to, you know, a pledge of allegiance that you're really pledging allegiance to a flag. Like, I believe that, but it gives me a little bit of pause. Like, what am I really, you know, what? Because you got the whole false idolatry thing, and the Constitution's not perfect, but there you are, standing with your weapon, kind of. Given an oath that you're going to swear and uphold this document that the country was founded upon, and you know it's not a perfect document. Maybe that's the whole point. Maybe it's the best we got. You know, but
right.
I mean, does that come up in the young people's minds or military people as they sort of go forward? Or
in my experience, no, they don't give a lot of thought.
Right.
It's a belief in the system. It's a belief in the way the things operate.
Right.
You know, if they don't trust and believe in their chain of command, then the military starts to fall apart.
That's
at that, and when they see a flag, it's heart-wrenching for them and people like myself to see some dirtbag stomping on the flag.
Oh, well, for sure.
Or burning it or destroying it in some way, or somebody with their hat on while the national anthem is being played. I mean, you want to rip their face off.
I guess there's a lot of middle ground between stomping and burning flags and like questioning maybe the, you know, some of the tenets of the Constitution.
It's the symbology, I think, of every predecessor they've had in front of them.
I understand that.
It's understanding the Pattons, the Chesties, all those guys that have come down through history. You know, they believe in these values and they understand that there are flaws in it. They understand that they will be reporting to an officer that may or may not have their act together. But that's just the way it works. And when you stop believing in that, then you stop believing in their entire way of life. I think it's very similar to what we see in our streets today here in St. Louis, where a police officer cannot do his or her job anymore without tremendous scrutiny, fair or otherwise. You know, if a guy takes a person down who's resisting arrest, now he or she has to be paranoid about everything they do. And for my friends in law enforcement, you are seeing a tremendous influx of people who are leaving the police force because they feel like they cannot do their job. That no matter if they do it by the book, they do it exactly the way they were trained, still the people like we saw in this area with the whole Mike Brown thing will be scrutinizing every move they make, and fair or not, they'll be judged for it before the situation is even over. You know, it's you have to have faith in the system. If you cannot have faith in the system, then we do fall into anarchy. We fall into things where we have no sense of law, we have no sense of order, there's no framework that we have to live our lives by.
But I think to bring the two topics together, I think one of the main tenets of the Constitution is is the citizenry being very aware of the power that the government provides, that, mm-hmm. that is over them. And who is watching over them with weapons, whether it's the federal government or mm-hmm. a cop with a gun. They're all government forces, right. government-funded forces that are that might be looking out for you, but they might be looking out against you. Mm-hmm. And the Constitution, in a lot of ways, is specifically written to make everybody aware that this can happen.
Right.
And so do you feel like any of the protesters who are speaking out against a government agent with a SWAT tank kind of facing them, do you feel like they're essentially doing their constitutional duty to resisting that force?
No, I think that's ridiculous. You know, to take military equipment away from law enforcement who are having rocks and stones and things thrown at them, and they look at that as a symbol and they start to, you know, they if they protest an unjust situation, then yes, they're doing their constitutional right to do that. But if they're just saying, I hate cops, I want to kill cops, I want to slaughter cops,
well, sure.
That right, that's ridiculous.
Well, I think
that's asinine.
I think we all agree with that. Yeah. I mean, I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think just yeah, blind hatred and just wanting to murder cops because they have a badge is stupid. But I think there's a lot of pushback against cops who are essentially government agents. Mm-hmm. That are given their force by the Constitution, that either may be abusing their power or enacting force upon the citizens, mm-hmm. which is exactly what's trying to be prevented. So you're right. Some of the protests were absolutely stupid. Some of the ideas behind the protests were just idiotic.
Awful.
You know,
right.
Like they had no concept. Maybe they didn't even know why they're out there. You know, I think mm-hmm. that's for sure. But you have to give some idea that there might be protesters and there might be ideas behind the protest that's not so stupid. They're not just
without question. Right. You know, and I can't speak on their behalf because I'm not a minority.
Right.
I've never been pulled over without a reason.
Sure, right.
I've never had a police officer be rude to me. I mean, right. I've been pulled over like everybody else
right.
has.
Right.
But I've never had a negative experience. You know, I've never had one. I've always been very polite. I've done exactly what's asked of me, and I've had a very
one of my favorite questions that I've asked these guys. Like, do you ever feel like you've been racially profiled in a good way?
What?
Like, oh, that guy might be doing something, but, you know, it's all right because he's all white. You know, do you ever feel like it's gone in your favor?
No.
I don't think on those terms.
It doesn't come up.
No. I mean, I live a very straight-laced life. I don't break the rules. I'm a rule follower. I believe in that. I believe in the system. So I guess I don't consider why I got off that time because I'm a white dude. I didn't get in trouble that time because I didn't do something to get in trouble for. You know, if I get pulled over for speeding, I've been let go many times. I didn't get pulled out of my car, thrown down the ground, and shot in the back of the head. I didn't get tased. But again, I was very respectful. The one time I was, I would say, profiled in a negative way, actually, is I walked into a restaurant down in Kings Highway. And I asked for a menu, and they said, I'm sorry, we don't have anything for you here. And it didn't register with me what they were talking about. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Right.
And I said, oh, no, I'm hungry. I'd like a lunch menu, please. I was very respectful, and then I got it. They said, no, we don't have anything for you here.
I was in a vegan place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, do you have a cow I could slaughter? Because I'm really hungry right now. No, it was, a minority-owned business, Bosnian, actually. And it just took me off guard. I said, oh, I got you. No problem. And then
are you
happened.
So all right. So let me pull on that a little bit because, you know, in a different time and place in a different situation, you know, that could have blown up, right?
Sure.
Had it been an establishment run by white people and you had been black, let's mm-hmm. say, I mean, that probably would have been all over the news.
Probably. I'm sure.
So why wasn't it? Why do you think?
Because I didn't make a stink about it. I think, well, if that's the way you want to treat me, you don't get my business.
Very good.
I didn't go in the back. I didn't pick up a rock and zing it through the window. I didn't shoot somebody in the back of the restaurant.
Now, did you feel like your rights had been violated?
I felt like they made a very poor decision. I didn't get that upset about it. I called a few of my friends that happened to work in the area and let them know about it. They'd probably be more likely to patronize the place again than I would. That's not my neighborhood. I was just down there
And then, of course, you called your lawyer, right? And
no, absolutely not. You know, if people want to act like that, I made this point before. You know, if you own a business, if you're a private citizen who owns a business, and you choose not to do business with a particular group, that's business suicide, but it's your right to do it.
Yeah.
All right? And I think it's crazy when you have these judges say, well, no, you have to do business with these people. For an example, I don't recall what state it was, but you had the bakery that refused to make a cake for, I believe, a lesbian couple.
Yes. Right.
And so the courts made them make this cake. If I was the lesbian couple, I'd be like, well, you know, the hell with you. I'll find somebody who deserves my business. And you have the right to do that. I don't think the government should be able to demand that you conduct your services. You have the right to you have the right to offer your services to people, and patrons have the right to tell you to go off yourself and go to somebody else.
Okay, I got to ask a question. Have you ever read Atlas Shrugged?
No.
Okay, you need to read it.
Don't bother. Don't read it. So, I mean, do you see that all of those sort of the laws that came out for about not being able to refuse service to someone, it was all from the 1965 Civil Rights Act, right? Wasn't it that about the era when all that came out? And yeah, I mean, back then, that's when you had the segregated water fountains and the lunch counters and all of the protests that were like, hey, I just want a sandwich at the lunch counter and you're not serving me. Sure, I mean, what did it matter? You just get lunch somewhere else. But right. I think it's indicative of real estate purchases, getting into neighborhoods you want to get into, mm-hmm. all of the things that represent systematic repression of minorities at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's now extended, you know, now to our time. Maybe it's outdated. Maybe we've all passed it, you know.
Which I don't really think we have, but
you know, but do you see the kind of the way that's tied to that history of
sure.
you know 50 years ago?
Yeah,
it's tough to apply, I guess, how it applies to our current society, right? Because I mean, I guess now in a modern society, you got your McDonald's, you have these
so many choices now. It's kind of
right,
let's go next
one. Right. So if we wanted to switch to politics, I gather you're a conservative
yes.
friend, like our friend Jeremy right. over here. Did you have any thoughts on the last two elections? So you had McCain Palin, awesome, and then you had followed by
not awesome,
followed by Romney, whoever Ryan.
I
forgot. Like, what do you have any thoughts about your Republican side?
Well, I got I had misgivings about McCain and Palin. I thought that was a poor choice. To be honest, I can see how
both are
Obama,
just for Palin.
McCain has his. You know, my mother lived in Arizona until she died, and so she had some very strong feelings about him. Said that more familiar with his politics, being from his state, and said that he changed his mind a lot, which I think you can change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a good argument or you have a different change of feelings, there's nothing wrong with saying, you know what, I looked at something harder, and now I have a different view on things. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a problem. I would have rather had him in there. Then Obama, I could see how Obama got elected, and I was a good sport about it, you know, when that first election in 2008, and thought, well, there's going to be a real turnaround in a couple areas, that maybe President Obama has the ability to make some positive change, mm-hmm. and I've been nothing but disappointed ever since. The 2012 election was, I was mystified at that, absolutely mystified. I was doing some security for a local official who was elected. And I'm watching the returns with them, and I was horrified to see that America reelected this guy after he had a miserably, miserably ineffective four-year first term. At that point, I started to think, what in the hell is going on with America?
But none of that was his fault, though. That was all the previous administration and everything
there,
else. Right, Rob?
Take it easy there, double conservatives. So were you more of a fan of the Romney Ryan ticket? Were you like, oh,
more,
they got
more,
it, these
more
guys.
So than McCain and Palin, yeah. Because
right.
I tell you what, I really like Ryan a lot.
Yeah.
And with our commie the way it was, you had Romney, who was a proven businessman.
Yeah.
And I felt that he could have turned some numbers, made some decisions from a real practical point of view, from an experience point of view.
Yeah.
So I think we would have been much better off today had that election gone a different way back in 12.
Yeah, I think I like the Romney campaign more than the I like the McCain. I got nothing for Sarah Palin. But I was more of a fan.
Yeah, that's kind of a head scratcher.
That's right.
I mean,
I was much more a fan of the McCain campaign. The Romney thing, like, I never really got what was really going on. I just didn't think he really ran the campaign. I don't go so far as you're what's wrong with America. I just don't think the Romney Ryan campaign, they didn't do it right. They didn't have the
no.
I don't think it was the right candidate. I'll have another one. I don't think they had the right candidate. I don't think they ran it right. I think they kind of weaseled around, kind of meandered around. They didn't really bring a conservative message or a moderate message. They just get kind of a nothing message. That was how I kind of took
it. I think they should have shown Romney in a more personal light after the election.
Yeah, right.
After the election, all these things come out, and you think, and you look at the guy, and you think, wow, he's kind of a cool guy.
Right.
He's
should have had him box
guy.
Holyfield before,
that's
yeah.
right.
before the election.
Right,
and not
the log flume at Disneyland or whatever.
I think just for kicks, he should have bit his ear off right there. Just munch it out.
That's right.
I could do this, too.
That's right.
The other one, right? The other one.
Yeah. Make a match.
So to connect it with the first topic, this is a good question for you. Do you mm-hmm. think it's possible to be a liberal and a patriot at the same time?
Oh, sure.
There you go.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, I have a lot of disagreements with the liberal point of view. My three sisters are all very liberal.
Oh, good for them.
To a radical way. And that's why I'm the black sheep of the family, without question. I'm the guy that they want around when things hit the fan. Then it's, get Keith in here, he'll fix it. But then when things are all smooth, it's, oh, yeah, he does that military thing. And, he does that, you know, and then I'm outcast again until the next family disaster. But I certainly don't feel as though you have to be an America hater to be a liberal.
Right.
I think there's parts we can all enjoy about different parts of the spectrum, and I think meeting somewhere in the middle is better for both parties instead of being extreme on the side.
So what did you think of the swift voting of John Kerry? I'm sure you weren't a John Kerry fan in 2004.
No.
But, hey, you got to give it to him. He did his military service. He got
his
shot
military
at.
Service.
You
yeah.
know, I mean, he may not have – you know, ended his military service the way you wanted to, but he was in the fight versus a lot of other people, right?
Yeah, you know, the thing when I remember back and think about that whole election was the falsification of this or the exaggeration of stories. And I don't think you have to exaggerate your military career. You know, the fact that you served and volunteered to do so, although he did back in Vietnam, you know, it says a lot about a person. And I think that speaks of itself. To sit there and like Hillary Clinton says, that she was under immense fire when she walked off the plane, and they had video of it, and she could have an umbrella singing in the rain, walking out of there casually to the car. I mean, that's a load of crap. And then you hear Brian Williams, who claims that, I mean, he was there when Lincoln was shot, and I don't think that happened either.
So. He was. So
I saw photos on the internet. I'm pretty sure that was true.
The internet says so.
We had a few on a trivia night here that would shed some light on the history of Brian Williams.
So are you implying that John Kerry brought the swift boat attacks on himself by highlighting his military experience?
If they were exaggerated, if you exaggerate them, because I know people came out at that point, and again, memory's a little rusty about that.
Mine's not.
Yeah, sure. But, I do think he brought some of that out. If he's just honest and say, look, this happened, I saw a moderate amount of activity when I was on the river in the boat crew, that goes a lot farther to earning my respect than saying I was under heavy engagements every single day and this and that. It's like, okay, well, that probably is a little bit of a fabrication, especially if you got signed the boat crew who's saying, oh, I was there and we didn't get shot at that much.
All right. Well, regardless of you know, how he ended his military service, I think we've mentioned this in the podcast before, but this was a turning point in politics when they took a new tactic of attacking whatever. You don't attack the politician's weakness, you attack their strength. Mm-hmm. So this was, he was the Democrat with the funny chin from Massachusetts with real military cred, right? Mm-hmm. And man, I don't think, regardless of what he did, I think they were going to go right after him no matter what.
Sure.
I don't think he brought it on himself. I think it was a tactic. I think it worked like a champ. And that's why now in 2015 we have a verb, swift boating, because it works.
I was very disturbed by his chin, though. I mean, that really threw me off. I lost
large,
a lot of sleep over that.
It's almost like a second face.
I was haunted by that. Very haunted by that.
And it's windsurfing. Yeah.
And the hunting with the tag still on the hunting gear.
Yes.
And all that kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, that's very impressive. I always leave my tags on all my assault gear, too.
That's
I think it's nice.
So you have to understand, and I think you've gone through this in your past elections, like one of the reasons why liberals got so excited about Obama is because we finally had somebody cool enough. Right?
I don't understand that. I've never seen him as a cool guy. He's
I think
a
back
nerd.
In 2008 he had that image. He had, hey man,
he
I'm
did.
Hip, I'm cool,
but,
and that
he did. But I don't understand why.
You don't understand it, but I completely understand. But look in relation. Look who he's compared against: Al Gore and John Kerry, which is like for us, it's just facepalm central.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, that's terrible.
That's right.
You're just like, God, just stop.
Now,
you know, just stop.
Now, he had Ludacris perform at the inaugural
who
ball.
Who
no,
did?
If he had.
Right.
Then we would have seen the
right,
contrast.
That's right. Yeah, so it's like we went through 8 years of like, oh, just quit already. You know, so then when we finally got somebody who wasn't John Kerry or Al Gore,
right.
We're like, oh, my God, we finally did it. Or Hillary Clinton.
I couldn't agree with you more. I see how he got elected in 2008, but I'm mystified that he got it back in 12. I mean, that was just a dismal record. That was shocking. And I you know, quite frankly, I would have voted for a beagle before I would have voted for Obama in 12.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
I want to back up just a bit. Something that may have been missed, I don't know. We've talked on the podcast before about the militarization of the police.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry has strong opinions on this.
Not a fan.
Not a fan. You mentioned now you are starting to train police forces.
Correct.
How do you see the militarization of police forces? How do you view that? Should there be limits?
Well, I mean, I don't think they need an anti-tank weapon. or M1A1 Abrams tank rolling down Broadway. But to give them protective personal gear, there is absolutely no problem with that. I mean, if we saw back in Ferguson, they're getting rocks bounced off their heads, and you want to take away their face shield.
I don't have a problem with that.
When I hear that, I think, all right, I'll tell you what. Then the people that want to yank their face shields away and their body armor, what if your son, your daughter, or whatever was a police officer, and they're standing that line, standing shoulder to shoulder with somebody, and you got people just sailing rocks and bottles over the crowd, and they're shattering in their face? You got to give them the means to protect themselves. You know, McCaskill came out saying, I think she wants them to be out there in Bermuda shorts with a slingshot.
I'd say, okay,
get your kids out there, have them stand next to her.
But it's when they roll into, you know, they roll down West Florissant in an MRAP.
Right.
That's where I draw the line.
Big difference between face shields and body armor, you know, in the face of rocks and maybe Molotov cocktails, and the MRAP rolling down in West Florissant, you know.
Right. Well, that thing is far from an MRAP. What they have is the armored vehicle. It's called the Bear. They had out with our training one day.
Well, regardless.
And it's simply a means of getting the team closer up to the objective because, quite frankly, a squad car does not provide protection against rifle rounds. It can shatter the window easily. It can shatter many of the body fenders. You know, when you have to get a team up close before you insert them, give them a tank. Give them whatever they want to get up there and do their job. You know, they're people that are our neighbors, our brothers, our sisters. And to take tools away that they need for the job, I think, is crazy. They came under fire for launching tear gas. So we're on the police case because we can't use lethal stuff. So now we give them non-lethal, and now we can't use that anymore. What exactly would you like them to do to disperse a crowd?
So
party favors?
Here's some guys, little poppers? Well, don't you think that they're escalating a situation by employing those tactics? They're escalating the situation rather than.
And there was a series of two nights. One when they had you saw the famous photos of the big, to me they look like tanks because I don't know what I'm talking about, and you know the big line of policemen in the big gear, and you know that was like one of the most violent kind of confrontations.
Right.
The next night everybody was still just as mad, but they didn't have quite the military gear. Well, there was still stuff that happened, but it wasn't as bad. It's almost like the protest is almost bound to rise to whatever the police bring, you know?
And I can see the point in that. I mean, there's certainly something very intimidating by seeing riot gear on a police officer walking by. Now, to me, the rational person would say, hold on a second, they got riot gear, so this rock is going to do a lot to them. Maybe I ought to not throw it. You know, the old adage that you don't bring a knife to a gunfight. You know, you have to protect these men and women. And we are seeing a massive exodus right now of some great police officers that are just tired of having their hands tied behind their back.
But do you think the urge to throw that rock is not the stupidity of just not understanding that it's not going to do anything, but just out of the core frustration of seeing what you perceive as cops harassing you, your family, your whole life, and now they're coming down with a tank, and maybe I'll get shot, but it's worth it for me to throw this rock at these guys.
It
might not be stupidity.
Precisely because
it's
not going to do anything.
A couple episodes ago, we talked about, you know, Martin Luther King said that riots are the language of the unheard.
Mm-hmm.
Those folks are doing the only thing they know how to do. This is kind of a last resort for them. They are just trying to make a statement, you know, send their message. I'm not saying they're doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not giving them, you know, carte blanche to, you know, certainly not to loot and burn their town. That's ridiculous and heinous. And, you know, all those people should be punished.
Absolutely.
But, you know, for the cops to roll in and try to do the shock and awe routine in the hopes that everybody is just going to cower at the majesty of the state, that's not going to work either.
Right.
So I think, you know, 10 years from now, we're probably going to look back on this and say, you know, this was the beginning of the community policing movement, right? It was when the cops realized that strong-arm tactics aren't going to get them where they want to go.
Right.
They need to dial it back a few notches and start building relationships on a more personal level.
Right.
And I think you're seeing a lot of
this coming from an anarchist who doesn't like cops, so, you know.
And there are a lot of, I mean, most of our local departments, and I know them very well, do exactly that. They have these neighborhood outreach teams.
And God bless them for that.
And it's a very difficult job, especially now.
I don't discount that at all.
Sure.
I'm just saying, you know, 95% of them give the other 5% a bad name.
Oh, of course. Like within every profession in the world, though. We all have professions in our day job. We have people who do our job very well, and we have people who do our job horribly.
Right.
And, you know, policemen are human beings, too, and they're not immune from that. They've gone through a long level of training. They deal with a lot of frustration. They have for many decades, long before Ferguson ever became an issue. And what I would really encourage people to do, which I've done many times, is ride with them on a night. You know, find a unit that's very active and ride along with them and see what they have to endure. It is it's a learning experience that I think so many people can learn from.
Can we record an episode from the backseat?
When you see the kind of garbage that they have to endure. I mean, really, it's amazing when you pull somebody over and they're looking at you and they're saying, they're just lying about their age and you're holding their ID. You're holding their ID and they're saying, no, I'm 16. I said, well, no, you're born in 1964. You're not 16. You know, I'm 16. And they lie to your face and you think, geez.
Come on. Yeah, and as a liberal member of the podcast, like I always seek to understand and have empathy for whoever's getting pushed down in that environment. So so if you're looting your store, it's just stupid. Like no argument there. And are there bad people running around doing bad stuff all the time?
Of course.
Like not a big deal. But I think you got to think that there's something that has motivated people to act the way they are, or to at least make their voice heard in a violent way, because that's the only way we're ever going to pay attention. Ever since Ferguson, there was a string of cop incidents that were recorded. The incident in New York, and there was the one in the Carolinas, and I think if the protesters did what you would call a good constitutional protest and maybe raised some signs and marched around in a circle a couple of times, I don't think it wouldn't have gotten the news cameras, it wouldn't have gotten the country's attention, and I think when that next thing happened, I don't think anybody would have cared. Mm-hmm. And there would have been another little march marching around the block. I think it took something violent, not the looting and the stupidity, but it took a show of force by the community to say, hey, we got a problem here. I mean, and now we got to figure out whatever the problem is.
It might be a deep conversation to have on this subject, but I think you look at parenting, we're raising kids that have no respect for authority. They have no respect for community and things like that, because unfortunately these poor communities are destroying themselves. You're not seeing people from Ferguson run down to Clayton and lay waste to it.
Oh, sure.
Or doing the burned earth or scorched earth plan. They're doing it to themselves. That's what I think a lot of people, and I can't begin to put myself in the feet of a young minority who is having a hard time making ends meet, who is surrounded by people who are doing rotten things, and you're trying to keep your head up. I know that I think back in high school, I went to Melville, and I was there the year that forced busing began, and that was a very interesting time. It was a great learning experience. Yeah. And I remember this young guy sitting next to me. I wish I could remember his name. Sat next to me in biology class, and as he and I would walk from third to fourth hour together in the same class, people would shout the most horrible things to him in the hallways. And he'd just take it. He kind of keep his head down and walk there. And I sat next to him one day, and I said, man, is it really worth it coming out here to listen to that crap? And he says, Keith, you have no idea where I came from. It's absolutely worth it.
Right. That's
how. And so I always fall back on that and think that he took the chance, I think, to get out of Ashan or Soldan.
Right.
And came out there, and that always gave me a different perspective on things. I can't put myself in his shoes because I don't know how bad it was.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think it starts with parenting a lot. In a lot of these poor communities, you see broken families,
right.
Non-existent dads, non-existent moms. You see brothers and sisters leading a horrible life very early.
Right.
Junior high, they're selling drugs and pot, and it's not leading to good things. Yep. You have to start somewhere, and I think the family is the key to do that.
Right, for sure. Yeah, no argument here.
Yeah.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Keith Hauser and probably some other topics that Rob hasn't even told us about yet. So stay with us. Keith Hauser, and we're going to ask him some questions about his primary business. Is that right? Shark
Correct.
Fitness?
That's the commercial enterprise. The military stuff is a nonprofit.
Okay. And so you're a fitness trainer?
Correct.
So how did you get into that?
Well, it kind of ties into what we talked about earlier. I had a friend of mine who was a police officer way back when, and I was always into exercise and taking care of myself. And he called me one day and he said, "Keith, I don't think I can be a cop anymore." And I said, "Well, why is that?" He goes, "Well, I got involved with a suspect today. My partner and I were chasing two guys. He went one way, I went the other. And this guy was kicking my ass. And I felt like if my partner would not have come back a few seconds later, he was going for my gun. And I wasn't doing anything to prevent that. I couldn't. He was overpowering me. And I can't be a police officer." I said, "Well, you know, I knew him for a long time." I said, "Let's just be patient for a second." And I started getting him to work out with me, just as friends. And about 9-10 months later, he called me. And he called me at 2 o'clock in the morning, woke me up, and he couldn't wait to tell me. He couldn't wait for the next morning. He said, "I got to call and thank you. I'm still going to be a cop." And I said, "Okay, thanks for the call at 2 a.m. You want to give me some details?" And he said, "Well, I got into another confrontation there with the suspect, and I mastered this guy. And I mastered him because of the skills you gave me. And so I feel like I can continue to be a police officer, something I want to do." And I couldn't go back to sleep. But I thought for a second, that's really cool. You know, he was a friend of mine, and I, in some small way, helped him continue his career that he loved. And I started thinking long and hard about it and thought, maybe I should do this. Maybe I've got a knack for helping people. And the personal satisfaction I got from helping him was incredible. And so started Shark Fitness eventually. And here I am, you know, and I'm fortunate to have clients that provide very similar stories to me. Maybe not quite as dramatic, but some very similar. And it couldn't be more rewarding.
All right.
It's a good story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So recently the good old Apple Watch came out. I hate all the stupid Apple stuff, even though I got an iPhone. Don't tell anyone. You know, they brought the Apple Watch out, and I was like...
There's some of that liberal hypocrisy.
That's right. I got it in spades. But... It's like I just didn't get it, and I guess it kind of had some kind of biometric thing. I don't know. Like, do you think any of the like technology is going to improve our fitness and our obesity epidemic?
Well, I tell you what, I think any tool that gets you moving, that gets you tracking things, and most importantly, makes you accountable for what you do,
right,
is a great tool to have. You know, when people go to the gym and they exercise blindly, they do the same weight, the same rep, the same routine every time. They have no idea what they did last time.
Are you talking to me?
Maybe, perhaps, yeah. Yeah, I heard from your wife.
When people named Rob go to the gym, and they do the same thing every time.
Every single time. So now when you start tracking it, if you know you did 100 pounds 10 times today, the next time you go there, you do 11. The next time you do 12, and maybe you bump the weight up. And so it's a way to guarantee that you're progressing forward.
Right.
You're not just hitting that stagnant thing, because when you hit something and you're not seeing progress forward, and you're giving up valuable time, and hard work, and it's uncomfortable, and you're not seeing result, then you quit. And when you quit, things don't go well for you. So any tool is a good tool,
right,
provided it's used properly.
Right. I just don't think it's going to do anything. I think there's been a lot of, you know, I like to see the, you remember Tony Little? Remember that guy?
The
Gazelle?
The Gazelle.
That thing was awesome. Remember the Gazelle?
Yeah, I kind of want to shoot him for that.
Unfortunately, remember
that. He's a moron.
You gotta do this thing. You remember that?
You
like a gazelle when you're doing
right.
it.
Right.
I mean, there's been fitness crazy.
I don't see too many gazelles like that, because they get eaten pretty quick.
Right. And he had the little ponytail. That guy was awesome. You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, fitness crazes. I think there's something about the willingness to push yourself to whatever that next level is. Mm-hmm. And like for some people, being able to track it is a motivating factor.
And it's a great tool. You know, these people who make it to professional athletics and the Olympics, they're not doing that by accident. They're doing that because they're tracking everything they do.
Oh, for sure. Everything.
And so that, if that's the key to success, if they're using that, then the everyday person could benefit from it.
Yeah, it's like if you're motivated, it's going to help you. It's not,
sure.
But it's not going to help you get motivated.
No, looking at the watch or like, you know, sticking it to a paint shaker to see how many steps you get for one day, it doesn't really work.
Does that work?
I've heard that people do that. They have office competitions, and they jokingly take it to Home Depot and throw it on a paint shaker. And just,
I'd be into that.
Oh, yeah, that's great. And then they show up, "Hey, look, I did 9,000 steps this hour."
Guy I used to work with claimed he would put it on his dog's collar, those little
exactly.
step counters, and
yeah.
let the dog run around.
Give the dog a Red Bull, and there he goes.
There you go. It's very much like that's very analogous to the Ferris Bueller, where they put the car up on the
yeah,
on the
screen, right,
exactly.
You know,
right.
And it didn't work.
Great strategies in human history. But it's funny. There's a lot of companies that are trying to reduce their healthcare costs, and they're trying to attract Fitbits on everybody. And there's, I mean, maybe we should invest in the paint shaker business.
Maybe.
I mean, no more gazelles.
You'd be a dominant champion in the office. I mean, you'd really be kicking some ass.
I've got 3,300 steps.
I shunned that competition at work.
This week?
Just today.
But Jerry stands up at his
Yeah, cubicle. I have a stand-up desk.
That's right.
Good. I mean, you know, anything that brings awareness to fitness, I think, is a good thing.
Right, right.
There's very few things you can say if it gets offices to talk about how many steps, or if it gets some kind of competition going where people feel more motivated to do something, it's not a bad thing.
Okay, so that addresses the active part of it, but what about the diet part of it? What sort of guidance do you give your clients when it comes to food?
Well, you can exercise perfectly every week, but if your nutrition is garbage, you're not going to see your goals. You'll be faster, you'll be stronger, you'll have greater endurance. But if weight loss is your thing, you're trying to tour that, it's all about nutrition, 100%. So, you know, the basic guidelines, 5 to 6 small meals a day, tapering your carbs as you go on. I think the best rule of thumb that I give clients is eat for what you have planned for the next 3 hours. So if it's a very active 3 hours, you can have more carbs and calories. If you're going to be sitting on your butt watching television, you don't need the carbs and you don't need the calories. Back off.
Right. Yeah, that's good advice.
Good tip. You know, Jeremy's got a little fitness training in him, so he's...
I teach a group fitness class, a 30-minute core strengthening class.
Good, good, excellent.
Jeremy likes to work the core.
It's not the only thing I work, Rob.
So to link it with patriotism and our great country, we like to pat ourselves on the back about the things that are uniquely American. We got some baseball, we got some apple pie,
right.
Pickup trucks that spew emissions and that sort of thing. Like, so what do you think about it? What do you think it is about America uniquely that makes us obese and, you know, epidemic that's going on? Like,
we are
be something that's America.
Absolutely.
American.
Yeah.
What do you think it is?
We're overfed and undernourished.
Why, though?
This lazy attitude that's been creeping into our society now for the past couple of decades, and more so, I think, that I've seen in the last 6.5 years. You know, it continues to climb. If you look at the numbers are horrific. You know, right now, a major general who's in charge of Army fitness said that we have officially made obesity a national security risk. And when I had a conversation with a retiring major general a couple of years ago, he warned me of this. He said, in a couple of years, Keith, you'll see this happen, and now it has. And that's horrifically embarrassing for our nation. And the reason why they come about that is right now, 1 in 10 high school kids cannot serve because they're obese. And they projected by the 2020, that could be up to 6 or 7 for every 10.
But, okay, so France has got their McDonald's. One of our great exports, you know. I mean, a lot of these other countries have access to the same old junk that we do. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think it is about our Stars and Stripes nation that makes us want to just shove our faces?
You know, That's the million-dollar question right there. Exactly what's leading to
that.
Well,
I got your answer.
I do, too.
Okay.
It's high-fructose corn syrup.
It's the crap we put in our food. That Americans have become spoiled. Americans have become the society that everything has to be an experience and delicious and fantastic. And you're seeing that in your food. So if we're supposed to eat 5 or 6 meals a day, there are too many people out there that think that has to be 5 or 6 really nice, cool, delicious, tasty meals. Whereas if we're eating 5 or 6 a day, we should have the same fanfare as we go put gas in our car.
Right, right.
You don't lift the nozzle out and you sniff the super and let it and say, wow, this is really good at Shell. This smells fantastic.
Well, I do.
And then you're
right.
Stuck
a little
in the tank,
buzz.
Right? You just have to get calories in there.
Some of us are gas snobs.
That's really weird.
I only do the high octane. I can afford it, baby.
Yeah.
But, all right, so I guess maybe we could all kind of apply our own kind of philosophies on this. But I think for me, I think this is my liberal agenda coming out. I think as Americans, we value nothing more than commercialism. That's our religion. It's our American thing.
Sure.
We try to market the best, and we try to sell what's tastiest, what's the sexiest, whatever it is. And that's what we do the best. It's our core export is whatever's easiest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in the belly of the beast. Us are our own American citizens, and so we're trained to get on the work treadmill, and you work to just continually try to, you know, do this capitalism thing. And I think then when you go to the Wendy's, you're like, well, I deserve, you know, you're more susceptible to that sort of marketing to yourself. It's like the only value that's been pushed to us in our kind of, I'm a big fan of capitalism for sure. You know, I'm not saying we go to a different system, but I think we're like immersed in this marketing consumerist sort of environment, which we ascribe a lot of positive behaviors to. Mm-hmm. Like when companies make money, oh, that's a good company. If some business is successful, that must be a good business. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing good for their consumers. It just means they're making money.
Right.
That's kind of what the stock market's built on, right? Mm-hmm. You don't buy a stock because they're being ethical. You buy a stock because it's going to make you money.
Right.
And I think that's the uniquely American approach to things that makes us just.
There are groups that are ethical traders.
Sure.
There are ethical traders.
Yes.
But I think the primary motive.
Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. There are groups who only trade in stocks that claim to be ethical.
I understand that. Good for them. I don't think that's the overall philosophy on Wall Street. Right. That's not the point of Wall Street.
Right. So as
the point of Wall Street is to make as much money for Wall Street or make money for your investors.
As we covered in our last episode when we were at the movies, we talked about The Corporation, which is a documentary about the evils of corporations in America. That is the bottom line, right? Make money. And the documentary, if you haven't seen it, Keith, the documentary kind of shows conclusive proof that if a corporation is considered a person, you know, under the law, that person is a psychopath.
In what ways? Given there's like four or five reasons.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of ways that they have no compassion for people, mm-hmm. right? All they care about is the bottom line. They don't care about the environment. I mean, the movie goes on and on, you know, documenting all these different things. So I agree with you up to the point that, you know, just because a company is making money doesn't mean they're adding value to society.
Exactly. Right.
I'm totally with you on that. And then, obviously, I'm no fan of a corporation because it's a government-created entity, so it needs to go. But I'm a big fan of capitalism, and right. I think that's going to solve a lot of the problems that society has that government can't or won't.
I don't think it's just the stupidity of our American brain. I think we're being awashed in something American that makes us act that way. I don't really. What do you think, Jeremy? He's got a thought.
Well, I was thinking about something else. Actually.
Oh,
I was wondering what Keith thinks about the Michelle Obama lunch program.
You know, the challenge. You see these elementary schools, and you walk in, and these kids are bringing their lunch now more because they don't eat that crap. You have to make it – it's a fine line between making it nutritious and making it pleasant enough for kids to eat.
Yes.
Kids are not the most easy little creatures to deal with.
Sure.
All right? And if it tastes like crap, you're going to have a hard time getting it down their throats.
Yes.
Without a taser. And then you got a whole other list of issues to worry about there. So it's a fine line. I like the idea that there's somebody trying to do something about monitoring calories and things, but you're just making it too easy for parents to send the garbage. And when the kids get the food, they go for the brownie, they chuck the healthy stuff right in the can, and eat the little dessert that comes with it.
Right.
That's what you see in elementary schools all over the city, all over the country.
Right.
You know, the specifics of her plan, basically when it says Michelle Obama, I'm trying to tune it out. I cannot stand her and her husband. I mean, jeez.
But I think the Michelle Obama health thing, it's just such a nice little thing. I mean, it's not... It's kind of like Laura Bush's reading program. Like, who's against reading? You know,
reading's good.
You know, vegetables, vegetables. I mean, I don't think it really solves it. It's just it's not really meant to solve the universe.
It's a nice hobby, I think.
But it's having,
as first ladies,
it's having non-trivial impact on students, on school districts financially, on extracurricular activities that can no longer have. Fundraisers where they sold pies, pizzas, whatever else.
Did we need more pies and pizzas?
I don't know.
We need
I don't
Girl
know
Scout
how many
kale
we need.
Boxes is what we need.
No,
Girl
we don't
Scout
that's
kale.
A hot seller. That's a big hot seller. Nothing says, let's eat like kale.
I don't know. I haven't really looked at it. I just saw it as like, this is this, you know, quaint program. We were just talking about my wife running for president sometime soon. I'd be first guy. I don't know what I'd be. And I was trying to think of like my like non-controversial project I would run.
No,
like,
no offense to her, but I wouldn't vote for her.
Oh, I would, because I want to be Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, she does know people.
the thing about Michelle Obama, I think they gave her a choice: you want to tackle school lunches or impotent squirrels? And she thought, well, you're probably sink my teeth into the whole lunch thing. Let's go with that.
It's a very easy thing.
I see where Jeremy's coming from on this, though. I mean, if we all agree that this is just something to keep the first lady occupied, then are we willing to stand back and accept the impact that it's having on schools and school districts?
Truthfully, I haven't looked into it that much. I just see her on Sesame Street lifting a lettuce. I don't know. It seems all right. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe we should make that the topic of our next episode. Hey, she's trying, though, right, Keith? At least she got her heart in the right place.
Oh, I don't know if her heart's in the right place.
Why not?
I
give her that.
I think they give her some homework. Yeah. I don't think her heart's in the right place.
No. What do you think the evil agenda is?
Give her liberal points.
I don't know.
Her intentions are good.
Come on, she says eat a vegetable, and you're ascribing evil to it.
No, I mean, eat a vegetable, but we have to look at things from a practical point of view, and I don't think that plan has one.
Yes.
I don't think it's very well thought out.
So can you say it's poorly executed, but it's the right idea?
Okay, all right, so...
There's poorly executed... Poorly planned.
Come on, it's the right idea. Just say.
So here's my question:
having kids eat healthier is absolutely the right idea because it's a train wreck now.
Yeah,
but I don't think she's the one to really champion the cause.
So here's my question, though: with the good food that she wants them to eat costs more,
right,
than the crappy food that they're normally served, right?
Right.
Right.
Well, and
I mean, we should be addressing that problem and. Right. And then
so it's,
the whole nutrition thing kind of solves itself, right?
If you see the movie Supersize Me, it came out some time ago with Morgan Spurlock.
I've seen it. Hey, yep. Nice job.
Yeah. In the extra credits, they talk about this one school district, and it's part of the movie, that it was a school for behavioral challenge kids. And the first thing they did is yank all the sugar out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they found that the principal found that they could feed the kids cheaper doing it his way with fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, properly prepared items.
Right.
He made it cheaper, and in a matter of like 60 days, their behavior was dramatically improved. The retention of the material was fantastically improved.
Right.
And he found a way to do it on his own. But now the government got involved in it, and now the good food costs a lot more, and you're just creaming these budgets.
How do we
get healthier food in there at a lesser cost?
Right, and it's just, I mean, if you even take it out of the schools, if you plot for yourself down in downtown St. Louis, you will have an easier time and a cheaper time finding a KFC and a Taco Bell
of
and
course.
Junk food
yeah,
than you will with a healthy salad. It's just going to cost more. So would you support government mandated taxes on monstrous pizzas
without question?
Really?
Nail them. Yeah.
But that's not very conservative.
Anything that gets our country healthier, because right now it's a train wreck.
Wow.
It is an absolute disaster. I say tax the crap out of soda. Tax it out of sugar. Tax their brains out.
Yeah, I wouldn't have called that one.
Without question. Because, well, I'll tell you what upsets me is looking at our nation. Our nation is horrifically unhealthy. Our nation's horrifically obese. When it's a national security risk, when our healthcare costs are rising dramatically every year, and we all have, obesity used to be an individual issue. If you had somebody who's heavy, okay, that was their problem. It's no longer their problem, it's our problem.
Well, every problem's our problem.
Exactly. So we're all paying for this in many ways. Your personal responsibility, your personal right to enjoy a seat, your personal right.
At a baseball game.
An airplane or a baseball game, you're exactly right. And it's not that you don't have sympathy for folks, but I have the right to enjoy a seat that I paid the same amount as you did. I should be able to occupy my seat alone, unless I choose to add someone to the seat.
Right?
That's a whole different story. That's kind of cool. But having somebody force themselves into your space because they don't fit in to what I just, for lack of a better, refer to it as a normal human dimension.
So I often think about this question. So I like to run around a little bit, and really, by the way I eat, which isn't terrible, but it's not going to win any Mr. Olympia awards. Like if I don't get those miles in, bad things are going to happen. You're going to see,
of course,
Ballooning Man over
you're
here.
See more
right?
of Rob, which
you're
going
to see more of me, right? And so I think there's sometimes when it's just moment of weakness and it's time for the Papa John's. Uh-huh. But I think there's. Do you ever kind of have empathy for those that, maybe just can't get in the cardio, or maybe they have a back condition or whatever it is?
I listen to that crap all the time. No, there's always a way. There's always a way. There are many medical conditions that make weight gain likely or make it hard to get weight off.
Right.
But then you don't compound it by eating a whole plate full of garbage every time you turn around.
Right.
I think most people would think, wait, my doctor just told me that I've got this horrific medication I have to be on. I'm going to gain weight. I have to do what I can to keep that off. I'm going to eat very healthy. I'm going to do what I can. Right. If you got a bad back, your upper body can work.
Right.
You know, if you got a bad finger, your lower body can work. You can find ways to do things. There are plenty of ways. There are very, 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 very few people that fall into that tiny little sliver that can't actually do something.
Right. And I think it goes well with, like you said, where you got to eat for the energy you're about to expend. If you can't move around a lot, well, you just don't need that much. You don't need that much
exactly.
energy. Right.
Exactly. You may not be able to get physically out and do things, but you can sure control what you put in your body.
Yep.
And I disagree with anybody who argues against that.
So you've been involved in a recent controversy.
I have. Yeah, absolutely.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, go ahead.
Just tell us what happened and how it all went down. And
well, I've got a unique style of doing things, to say the least. I'm very direct because I think all too often we look at our society and we're too afraid to address issues, and I'm not. So I did put a picture I took at a Cardinal game recently. It was a woman who was sitting in front in over one seat who was morbidly obese by definition, and she did not fit into her seat. And the Cardinal fan who had the seat directly in front of me could not sit in her seat. After two innings, she had to ask to leave because physically she couldn't sit back. And I've had that happen to me an endless number of times, especially on airplanes. And it's very uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. Nobody wants to be the jerk to say, hey, do you mind squeezing over that way? It's just a miserable situation for everybody. The person who doesn't fit in the seat, the person who's now inconvenienced by sharing it with somebody else. So I took a picture of that, and on the Facebook page for my company, I posted the picture and used it to frame a conversation like every media outlet has done an endless number of times. Today I saw another story coming up, and they framed it by showing an anonymous person like I did of an abused person. But I'm a small business owner. I'm reachable. I'm right here, so I'm easy to get to, unlike Fox News. If you tell Fox News they can't put a video of somebody obese on there, they're going to ignore you. They don't care what you think. But I'm a little guy here.
Right.
And so I put that on, and somebody who saw it got very upset and called a local news station. They did an interview with me about it and butchered the interview, to say it nicely. I mean, slaughtered it. Absolutely slaughtered it. I gave a lot of talking points. Talked about how it's a public issue, put my reasons behind it, asked them, the reporter, several times, I know that your station has done the exact same thing, so why am I under fire? And that was all left on the editing floor.
Mm-hmm.
And it caught the internet trolls' attention.
Of course.
And they came on to hoard for a couple days. And what was really bizarre about it is that very few of them actually made constructive comments.
Right.
A majority of them who are upset with me for this whole bullying thing, I don't think that's bullying, by the way, and fat shaming, the new catchphrase,
right,
is they would go on my website, find my clients' pictures, and insult them far more than I could ever insult an anonymous picture at a Cardinal game. They want to people that we had linked photos to and called them anorexic, horse face, ugly. They went to somebody else and said that I see that your mother died of cancer and was fat. I hope you get fat and die of cancer so he can shame you too. So these are the people that are upset about bullying, and that's the way that they voice their views. And I'll tell you, to be honest, it took the sting out of it. When you see such a moronic response as that, you start to think, wow, this is the people who I upset. I don't really...
Not worried about upsetting them anymore.
Exactly. Right. I'm not worried about upsetting people who do that kind of stuff. Now, there are a lot of people who made some very, very good comments and very constructive comments. And I would read those and think about them in that. And one in particular got my attention. She said, I'm a trainer, and I think you and I are a lot alike because I find myself getting very angry at clients who don't want to be as healthy as I want them to be. And you work, you bring all your tools and all your motivation and everything you have to offer to help that person, and they, quite frankly, just don't have the interest. It gets very frustrating, and I surprisingly never realized that, but that was true. And then something very, very unique happened is you start to see the switch from horrifically negative toward me to very, very positive, especially starting from my clients, who I am very fortunate to have. They've been in my program an average of 7 years now. They have a loyalty that you can't buy, create, or manufacture. It's just that way, and I like to believe that because I've earned their respect and loyalty because of my approach to fitness, because I've always tried to go out of my way to help people, and I've offered a lot of things without charging for it. And then you saw the really unique aspect of it, of the initial people that hated my guts starting to turn. And one in particular I'm thinking about was very quick to kind of cause me a lot of issues professionally. And a week later she's talking to me and telling me, you know, I got to be honest, Keith, you cannot stop doing things the way you do. It works. And it caught me off guard.
But there's no news story about that.
Of course
that
not.
Doesn't,
right, no, of course not.
Attention.
That doesn't make the cool title, yeah, right? Because now it says, well, hey, maybe this guy's methods are not to everybody's liking, but they work. you know? And I've always tried to tell stories, and I don't really prepare a lot of stuff before class. They just come to me. Or if I see something on the media I want to talk about, I'll relate that to my story. And I think when you tie things in a very direct manner, the way I say things, it sticks. If I go up there the same day and say, well, let's all eat my 5 to 6 meals a day and make sure you have the right calorie. All right, but if I say, hey, look, you're going to blow the button off your pants and kill somebody. All right, don't eat that much. Stop it. All right, they think about that. And the lady I referred to said, you know, here's the funny thing, Keith, is I was ordering lunch with my grandkids. I'm at my favorite restaurant. I'm looking through there, and I see my favorite double cheeseburger, my soda. And right as I get ready to order it, I think, wait a minute. What if Keith is standing behind me?
What would Keith do?
What would Keith do? Yeah, there you go. It's another bracelet idea. I'm working on that.
Work on it.
I got a great logo with it, too, the whole thing. But anyway. So she said, at that point, I realized I acted emotionally in my reaction to Keith and brought these actions upon his program. That was wrong for me to do that. And she said, I ordered iced tea and a salad that day.
And it was fine.
And I realized that your methods work. Mm-hmm. It was a painful thing. I didn't want to admit it to myself. She said she called some family members and said, I just had this little revelation. What do you think about that? And her family member said, the guy's right. You can't argue with him. He's right. You may not like the way he delivers it,
right,
but he is right.
Right.
So I guess to keep people happy, I thought long and hard about this, and based on a couple responses I got, I thought, well, although the picture I took was anonymous, I put myself in the shoes of her family members. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that would kind of suck.
Yeah.
That would suck if that was my sister. Well, I don't have an obese sister, but I'm saying if that was my sister, I'd think, man, that's terrible. And I felt remorse about that, and that's why I took the picture down and apologized for it. I do not apologize for my views on the subject.
Sure.
That if you are so big you can't fit into a seat, you do not have the right to inconvenience somebody else next to you. I sat on a flight numerous times, one of which in particular, that this woman sat down, is on Southwest, and is the last seat in the plane. And I'm always in the aisle for a variety of reasons, but the middle seat's open. I thought, oh, here it goes. And she plops down next to me. Before the flight takes off, she asks for, she pulls 2 cheese danishes out of her purse, a bag of chips, and asks the flight attendant, can I get a couple Coronas when the plane takes off? Before the damn thing leaves the gate. Now, she doesn't fit in the seat. She's hanging over the armrest, under the armrest, and by the end of the 2.5-hour flight, I get off this thing, my shirt and my leg were soaked with her sweat.
Oh,
and there's nowhere for me to go. All right, I can't climb in the overhead bin. I'm too big for that. I couldn't stand up. They'd be yelling at me for that. I'd be arrested on landing. I just had to sit there and deal with it. And I get off the plane, and literally looked like somebody dumped a water down my right side. And this happens all too often. And as I talk to people about it, about the story, every single person says, oh, that's happened to me. Let me tell you the story about this, and let me tell you the story about that. It happens all the time. And like I said, you know, to start the whole conversation about this, I don't have the right to hog somebody else's seat. You know?
No.
I know I've got wider shoulders than most, which I take the aisle so I can lean outward a little bit. So I'm not banging the person in the center seat, all right? Just because I'm respectful of other people. But that's often not shared toward us. And the debate would go on, well, poor her, poor this, poor that. And I agree. You know, I can't imagine being 350 pounds. I can't imagine the extraordinary limitations I would face every single day from doing even the most minute activities.
Mm-hmm.
That would be horrible. But I bet that there's something I could be doing about it. And that's where our society is supposed to just swallow it and say, poor her, so suck it up. Well, I don't think that's fair.
About the controversy, do you think it would have been different if the picture you took, if that had been a man, or if you had not posted a picture at all and just described what you saw?
Yeah. Do I think it'd be different as a man? No.
No?
I don't think so. Although a lot of people that chimed in saying, well, why isn't there a picture of a man on there? Well, I don't know. The guy in front of me wasn't a man. It was a woman, so I just took a picture of the situation. You know, people who are saying, are you a woman hater? That's ridiculous. I mean, of course not. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Right.
As far as if I would have put a picture to it, the idea is that I was framing a story. And I guess I felt entitled to do that, or that is acceptable, because literally every single time you turn on a news station, when they cover obesity, they're framing it with a picture or a video.
We always get
they
that
B-roll.
B-roll.
Down the street eating an ice cream.
Right.
Yeah,
it's cropped at the neck.
Cropped at the neck. Just like my picture, I got the back of her head. You couldn't identify her.
Every time I see that B-roll, I'm always afraid that I'm going to show up on there. You know?
I don't think you have
that guy. That guy likes the same shirt. Oh, it's me. You know?
I mean, at worst, I might say something about the haircut, but no, not about
the haircut. Yeah, the haircut could use a little work.
No, so, you know, that's kind of where I came from that. Yeah.
So I am not a fan of the term whatever shaming.
Blank hyphen shaming.
It's crap.
It's just another throwaway term that somebody invented and now it's used for everything.
I agree.
Why is some shaming okay? Like the website People of Walmart or the emails that go around. That is shaming.
Walmart shaming.
But that's okay because it's funny.
It's funny, right?
You know, right. See, now how is that any different? In fact, they're saying it to be malicious with the intent of ridiculing somebody.
Right. There's
I'm
no
a fitness professional. I'm saying that to frame a story that we were talking about in class.
Yeah.
And the reason why I framed the picture with her, the infamous one is her wiping the cheese out of the thing, is because somebody said, well, how do you know she doesn't have a medical issue? How do you know she doesn't have this and that? And she very well may.
Right.
I have no idea of knowing that. But what doesn't help the fact is we need 2 servings of nachos, 2 pretzels, and 3 sodas. That's not helping the situation. You're not out there trying to do good for yourself doing that.
Right.
And I don't believe the cheat day. I think that's crap. I don't believe the cheat meal. I think that's crap, too. You know, I've had some pretty strict things, and I tell my clients that if by medical definition, that's the key, I'm not judging somebody, I'm not putting my 2 cents in, if by medical definition you are unhealthy, that your weight is now causing you to have a shorter term of life and a lesser quality of life, then you are not entitled to have any kind of treat or anything until you get within a healthy zone.
Right.
When you're healthy, then if you want to indulge in a beverage or a dessert or something and you're healthy, by all means do so. But it's funny because the people that are typically very, very healthy, they don't want that crap anymore.
Well,
they realize how hard it is to keep themselves in prime physical condition. They don't want the nachos. They don't want the pretzels. They don't want the sodas.
I've had a cheat week before.
Yeah, that's crap. Complete crap. Garbage. But again, you're
hey,
also...
He's calling you out,
you're
Rob.
You're not obese.
Well, so I know.
Is that okay? No, because there are some people, and the other argument is, well, there are some thin people out there that are very unhealthy. I could not agree more. I go back to a client that I think of right now whose diet consisted of nothing but caffeine, alcohol, and chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
That's all she
ate.
That
is awesome.
Yeah. and but here's the kicker to it is I would ride her hard about that. I said, you know, that's crap. That's garbage.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what you're doing to yourself? And after beating her down so many days, she finally cleaned her diet up. She finally introduced fruit for the first time and something called a vegetable. And she got away from the chocolate and that. And then she comes back and tells me a couple months later, she says, I've never felt better. I had no idea how bad I felt before.
Right.
Now I feel great.
Because I think there's something about – it's good that you mentioned that because I think there's something – like the obesity thing is a thing that you can see. But I think there's like all sorts of, you know, regrets we've had, bad things, bad behaviors, you know, whatever we're all doing wrong, except for me. I'm kind of holy in that manner.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that you just don't see. And this is the particular thing that you see. But it's good that you're empathetic to know that there's a lot of – that we're all kind of screwed up, you know. And there's – you know, we're going to work
perfect.
On our thing. Right.
Without question, you know. And every single person I've ever met, myself included, could do more to help themselves physically.
Right. Or anywhere.
You know, and but we all have to try. And there's a point, though, that when you let yourself go so badly that now you're affecting the entire nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an issue. You know, that's a tremendous issue. And we're doing a miserable job at addressing that. And I'm someone that will always get up for the fight and say, okay, look, that's not okay. Because, again, you know, when you look at our nation, and now St. Louis in particular is 62% overweight. That just came out a few weeks ago, right about the time all this stuff hit the fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I hesitated to put him on there until things died down a little bit. I had somebody who was advising me very wisely to this and that, and she censored me and drove me nuts. But nonetheless, I listened. I did exactly what I was told.
I'm sure we're just as obese.
Smart man.
Now.
You know, but we have to do a better job because right now it is far too easy. Everybody's out there empowering someone. And one of the things I tell my class is this, that if you walked in your room and your loved one had a pistol up against their head, and they're getting ready to squeeze the trigger and blast their face all over the wall, you would do everything you could to stop that from happening, right? You'd plead with them. You'd beg them. You'd tell them life's too precious to give it up. But we'll sit there and watch the same person eat and drink themselves to death. It's a slower demise. The result's the same, all right? They're going to die. It's just one involves less cleanup, right?
Right.
So we do such a crappy job. And right around the time all that hit the fan, I was talking to my clients a lot for the previous 2 weeks about find somebody in your close circle of friends you care about and address it with them. Get the cojones up to ask them to talk honestly about being healthier. And we had several clients do exactly that. I remember one in particular. She said that it took her a lot of time to get the nerve up to it, and she asked her friend out for dinner, and she was nervous, and her friend even picked up on it. And she said, I got to talk to you. I've just noticed the past couple of years that you're gaining a lot of weight. And I know that we've all gone out before as a group, and everybody just kind of does the same thing, but I'm really worried about you. And she stopped, and she thought then, she said, oh, man, I said the wrong thing. She's getting ready to, like, chop me apart with a salad knife. And her friend started to cry and got up and walked across the table, and, you know, they started crying together because I guess chicks cry at everything. But they're bawling their eyes out.
I understand it.
And her friend said that was the most powerful thing ever said to me, and I can't thank you enough. And she promised to get in shape, and she promised to start doing better with her nutrition. So what if everybody did that instead of just sit there on their butt watching Aunt Mildred balloon up, you know? Because you know it's going to happen, right? Yep. You walk into a retirement home, there are not very many 80-year-olds who are 300-400 pounds. They've all passed on.
Right.
So we're losing great people who could be very productive in society because they're eating themselves to death. And our country doesn't want to confront anyone, doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. That's, you know, I'm sorry to say, that's that liberal hug me kind of thing. Sometimes it just doesn't work, right? It doesn't work when it comes to terrorists, and it doesn't work when it comes to addressing problems. Sometimes you just got to hit in the face. So I think if we, it's a lot easier to sit by. And the other thing I like about this subject or talk about it is, you know, if you had a genie in a bottle and you rub the side of that thing and a genie popped out, and you could say, the genie says, look, I'm going to grant you a wish based on your body image. You could have any image you want. How many people are going to say, make me 300 pounds? That sounds really great. Mm-hmm. I can't. You know, I've been pushing 290. I want to go all the way to 3. No, hell no. Then I'll say,
goals.
I want to look like, I want to have a great body fat percentage. I want to look good in a swimsuit, you know.
That's right.
I want to be a rock star.
I'm working on a big tan.
But the thing is, the problem is that it's sure as hell a lot easier to say how proud you are to be obese. It's a lot easier to say that you really like being there than it is to put the work out there to get healthy in the first place. That's the difference. That's the problem, the laziness.
So, okay. This story broke a month ago. Post-Dispatch mm-hmm. covered it. I'm sure you went out there and read some of the comments.
Not many, but few. Sure, I got a selection of them.
So I did, just earlier today, as a matter of fact. And I'm overwhelmed, first of all, by how many people are just, you know, the vitriol that was being spewed. I mean, they're not addressing the issue. It's just, it's a dog pile.
Sure.
Frankly, it's everybody, you know, oh, well, you know, he screwed up. Let's all just jump
pile on
him and make him, you know, make him the enemy. I think, you know, we've already talked about what you did was not outside of what any journalistic outlet would do to mm-hmm. illustrate the problem.
Correct.
You know, you did not identify the person by name. The photo was not good enough to identify the person, except for maybe their close family and friends,
sure.
like you've already said.
Well, they had their last name, Wainwright, or a relative of Adam Wainwright.
Yeah, that's the point I made to report it. They asked me, I said, well, you identified. I said, well, I don't think that's Adam Wainwright. I'm not sure.
Not sure.
I don't think he's sitting up in right field. And, boy, you know, they say the camera puts on 10 pounds, but, I mean, apparently in this case
how
it took
cameras
off
were on
a couple
it?
Hundred.
I think the response was disproportionate is what I'm saying.
I would agree. I would agree.
You know, I don't think what you did was out of line. And I, you know, as far as illustrating the point to your clientele, to your audience, mm-hmm. on Facebook, wherever you posted this, beyond Facebook. I don't know if you posted it.
Oh, no. It was just posted on Facebook for my closed community.
And we've talked on the show before about Facebook. And you know.
It's hell on earth.
Yeah.
If I didn't have three businesses I had to promote, you know, I would not be on Facebook because I don't care that your daughter crapped her pants today.
Yeah.
It's not a big thing to me.
But hell is other people, right?
Right.
And that is what Facebook is.
Right,
so
exactly.
There you go. Okay, so the comments that I read, most of them are idiotic, but some of them tried to, you know, be legitimate
mm-hmm.
and challenge the notion that you posted this woman's photo against her permission. Which is ridiculous,
right?
Because, I mean, number one, you're in a public place.
Correct.
There's no expectation of privacy in a public place.
That's
the
right.
law doesn't support that. And furthermore, you didn't take a picture of her face,
mm-hmm.
so she's not even identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I have a lot of issues with most of the people that left comments, but I was surprised that there weren't more comments supporting you.
Well, I tell you, and the reason for that is that the person who's helped me with the website or with the Facebook page and I spent the first several hours removing the people that supported me, including my clients, because anyone who did say a word of support was attacked with equal nastiness as I was. So I'm not going to put my clients through that. I mean, we didn't get to some enough. They went through every photo on the whole Facebook page. For all these years I've had that, and would go to their personal page and say, you're an anorexic, blah, blah, blah. It got just nasty and vicious. And I encourage my clients, don't say anything. I'll take, this is me, not you. Don't get involved in this. You know, they expressed their support to me in ways I would have never imagined, in a way that no fitness trainer could ever expect their clients to do so. They did that, and that's the rewarding part. You know, I've told people that this experience was the lowest of my career in some ways, but in far more ways than that, it was the highest part of my career. You don't realize, I guess, the kind of dedication that your clients have until you go through something like this, and they come out of the woodwork to back you up.
And I think you're not getting a cross section of society or a cross section of, you know, society or like-minded people or anything. You're getting a cross section of people who comment on internet trolls. You know,
that's exactly what they do.
So it's like you have to kind of take the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very 2015 thing. Like,
exactly.
20 years ago, it wouldn't have happened just like this.
No
20
way.
Years from now, it's going to be different. I don't know what it is, but hopefully Facebook will be gone. But I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe it'll get worse. I don't know what it is.
I would bet it's going to get worse, to be honest.
Right.
I mean, you know, we have so many avenues of social media,
yeah.
And who knows what's going to develop now. I mean,
right.
We all think, well, how could it get worse than this? But they said that 10 years ago.
I think the NSA will just be running it at that point.
That's fine.
So
that's
we'll
great.
Cut out the middleman. And
that's the only Twitter account you can follow. At NSA.
I don't have a problem with the NSA. I've got nothing to hide from them. If they want to listen to my cup, they're going to hear some pretty good jokes, probably some pretty raunchy jokes at that, because, you know, my sense of humor. There are some off-color comments about this and that. I'm sure they'll hear that. But, you know, they don't have to worry about me.
I love the NSA personally. Every time I accidentally delete an email, I just call them up and they
just
can
give
restore
a call.
It. So,
see,
you know.
That is your tax dollars at work, and
that's
I appreciate
right.
that.
It's a great service. All right. So, We have probably reached the end of yet another episode. I want to thank Keith for being with us, being our special guest. We really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to thank Rob for organizing this. Good job, Rob.
I know the good people.
Yeah.
Keith, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think we covered it tonight. You know, I would just hope that people start taking responsibility for themselves. Maybe get back to the old-fashioned work ethic that we used to enjoy back in the 40s and 50s when America was at its finest, before it came to this cesspool we have now of people who just want to get by and barely do enough to squeeze through and, you know, make just enough cash to buy their beer on the weekends and not to get repoed. I fight lazy every day. I hate lazy. Cannot stand it. And I would encourage people to stop being worthless.
All right. I can get behind that. Although we have an awful lot of lazy here on the show, so.
This is exhausting.
All right, I want to thank our listeners. I want to thank GC for hosting us once again and remodeling the bar for us. That was great. You didn't need to do that. So we'll see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.
Good night.